Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. And this article is entitled, Would You Like to Look at the Desert Menu? Aaron Lopez recently opened a restaurant that revolves around ingredients sourced from the Southwest's harshest landscape. It's by Jen Murphy. Scarcity fosters creativity, said Chef Aaron Lopez as he placed a small woven basket on my plate. He removed the lid to reveal two amaranth leaf-topped squares that looked like artisanal chocolates. I lifted one and took a bite. The creme brulee-like shell scattered, releasing a sweet, fibrous, squash-filled interior laced with subtle heat. It was late June, and Lopez, 38, invited me to his hometown, the inland Southern California city of El Centro, to preview the menu of his ambitious new restaurant, Ursa, which pays homage to the deserts of the American Southwest. The freshly lime-washed walls of the dining room were decorated with tumbleweeds gathered from his mom's backyard and lined with cacti grown in clay pots. In the kitchen, his fridge and pantry were stocked with esoteric ingredients, a cactus glaze, cold-pickled desert mallow shrub, prickly pear sambal, bee pollen shoyu, mesquite sap. Lopez is on a mission to reimagine forgotten desert foods and ignite a sense of pride and possibility around a cuisine largely defined by chilies. Those bite-sized squash snacks were created by borrowing from the indigenous technique of nixtamalization. Traditionally, the process involves steeping and cooking corn in an alkaline solution, which makes it easier to grind into masa for tortillas. Lopez applies a similar method to this dish, soaking the mixture in the solution for 2 days before cooking it in agave syrup. He then shapes it into squares that are lightly fried to create a paper-thin, sugary crust, and then tops the whole thing with a sticky fudge-like sauce made from fermented hatch chilies and squash seed shio koji, a Japanese marinade. The result was a perfect combination of sweet and savory. What drew me to cooking wasn't a desire to nourish people, Lopez told me over kombucha he ages in snoring clay pots. I was fascinated with manipulating ingredients, turning something unexpected or unappetizing into something delicious. Before he embarked on a career in the kitchen, he was a sculptor and played bass in a punk band. Perhaps it takes the eyes of an artist to see a landscape of sun-scorched earth, spiky plants, petrified forests, and stinging critters as bountiful. Since leasing the 43-seat restaurant space in January, Lopez and his wife, June Chi, have been hiking, foraging, and camping across the Southwest, including Joshua Tree National Park, 95 miles north. On his journey, Lopez has learned how native people thrived in these harsh landscapes, relying on drought and heat-tolerant crops such as chia, with its fiber-rich seeds and tepary beans, small brown legumes with a chestnut flavor. I bring foraging guides on what the Pueblo ate and a point-and-shoot camera, and we pull into secluded areas, pluck some ingredients to taste, and scribble field notes, he said. The desert is often a punishing place to harvest from. It can feel like you're foraging on the sun, said Lopez. In the summer, it's not unusual for the couple to head out as early as 3:30 in the morning to beat the heat. They bring along their dogs, Lola and Jupiter, to warn of rattlesnakes and chase away tarantulas. Thick gloves are essential. Lopez estimates that he owns 24 pairs. I'm constantly shopping for ones that won't puncture when I'm dethorning things like prickly pear, he said. I've almost become immune to the cuts and stab wounds. Lopez never imagined he'd return home. As a teenager, he didn't see a future in El Centro, a gritty city just over 2 hours east of San Diego, in California's Imperial Valley, and 15 miles north of the Mexican border town of Mexicali. I ran away from the desert as soon as I could, he says. After graduating from the Cordon Bleu Culinary School in Los Angeles in 2012, he spent 4 years cutting his teeth at some of the city's top restaurants, notably the Michelin-starred Orsa and Winston, where he helped craft the 25-course tasting menu nightly. He then decamped to Honolulu for 6 years and made a name for himself pushing flavor boundaries at the now-shuttered Hey Ho House, a high-end gastropub. But it was during this time in the tropics that Lopez started to feel the tug of the desert. I'd come back to visit and look at the landscape with a different perspective, he said. On these trips, he'd speak with foragers and members of local indigenous communities, and those conversations turned him in a new direction. I realized my heart was in the desert. I want to show the culinary community that our products can compete with those grown in a more hospitable climate. Lopez isn't the only one exploring the potential of resilient desert flora as ingredients. Scientists think that wild desert plants such as the nitrogen-fixing tree legumes and water-efficient succulents could be critical to sustainable farming in a hotter, more arid world. Ahead of my trip to Ursa, I called Erin Reardon, conservation research scientist at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum outside Tucson. She told me that many crops grown in the nation's deserts, wheat and barley to name two, aren't naturally designed to thrive in xeric climates because they didn't originate there. As weather became more extreme, such crops require more water, chemicals, and electricity to grow. This is of particular concern in Imperial Country, which is the state's driest and only county, which is the state's driest and only receives 2 to 3 inches of rain each year. The county has allocated the single largest share of water from the Colorado River, but that waterway continues to dry up, forcing the valley's 400-some farmers to drastically reduce their usage for crops like broccoli, lettuce, and wheat. In 2020, Riordan co-authored a University of Arizona study that evaluated plants traditionally eaten by the Sonoran Desert's indigenous cultures, such as cacti and agaves. These species are already adapted to the arid weather, require less water and energy, and produce more reliable yields, she told me. They're also rich in nutrients and antioxidants. Like Lopez, Riordan sees deserts not as wastelands, but as laboratories for food. She's involved in a three-year project funded by USDA that's working with Arizona farmers to identify hardy, desert-adapted crops, promote climate-smart farming practices, and raise consumer awareness. She believes that chefs like Lopez can help influence the appeal of these foods. Farmers are wary of switching to desert crops because they don't know if they'll be able to move the product, she said. We have to expand the palate of the general public to build a market. Back at URSA, named for the constellation, Lopez excitedly showed me a space she's building as a kind of lab dedicated to exploring the terroir of the Great Basin in the Mojave, Chihuahua, and Sonoran deserts. His inspirations star Nordic chef Rene Redzepi, forthcoming Copenhagen Food Lab, and acclaimed Peruvian chef Virgilio Martinez Research Center in Lima, which employs a team of sociologists, botanists, and anthropologists to study native ingredients. Lopez is in the process of hiring a director to research recipes and techniques used by indigenous communities. When the lab is completed early next year, the two of them will meet with the restaurant's network of foragers, then test ingredients and develop recipes that address culinary questions like, what happens when you dehydrate lamb's quarters, an edible weed? Can you age brine and slightly cold smoke barrel cactus seeds to emulate caviar? Lopez has also sought out wisdom from the indigenous communities. On a series of R&D trips, he met with members of Arizona's Tohono O'odham Nation, which introduced him to the prize buds of the Choya cactus, which bloom each spring. Lopez cooks the buds sous vide in a mushroom brine, dries them, and then shaves them like truffles to add an earthy punch to dishes. Ramona Bouton, the proprietor of Ramona Farms on the Gila River Indian Reservation in Arizona, has become Lopez's fixer for finely stone-ground, cob-roasted pima corn known as gatyusa. A dry dining ingredient he hopes to revitalize. For my meal, he turned it into comforting nutty grits topped with sour corn pudding, and fall-off-your-fork corned antelope, his twist on corned beef. Lopez has adopted the zero-waste mentality long embraced by native communities, too. He steeps the pods of the ironwood tree, for example, to make tea, and he turns scraps of wild boar into an umami-rich fermented garum, a riff on fish sauce. My favorite example of whole ingredient cooking was a flan-like dessert crafted from all four parts of mesquite. A food so important to the Tohono O'odham that they once had a lunar calendar month dedicated to it. I asked Lopez if he thought his hometown, where one-fifth of the population lives in poverty, is ready for a fine dining concept. He scratched his scraggly brown beard as his pale blue eyes gazed towards his dilapidated storefront. We have to be accessible for the locals to trust us, he replied, and he acknowledged that he had abandoned his original tasting menu concept. Instead, the restaurant offers a menu of 15 shareable items, priced between $6 and $22 per dish, served to a funky soundtrack of disco, hip-hop, and soul. Do I have dreams of Michelin coming to our town one day? Sure, he admitted, but I care more about making our community and all desert people proud of the foods that shape our identity. That's how I define success. And like most things in the desert, you just need to work a little harder for it. This was out by outside correspondent Jen Murphy, who was a former travel editor at Food and Wine. And next up, we have Dear Gear. I'm getting ready for my first marathon in the fall, and I'm trying to dial in my kit. I keep hearing about these super shoes people use for racing, but they're expensive, and I don't know if I should switch to something new for race day. Do I need to buy a new super shoe to run my best? From Newbie Distance Runner. Dear Newbie, super shoes are no doubt attractive. The lightweight racers with ultra-bouncy foam and embedded carbon plates have been shown to enable some athletes to reach higher speeds with less effort. Could a super shoe help you run slightly faster and easier than you would in a standard trainer or racer? Yes, probably, maybe. It's complicated. If you're a sub-7-minute mile marathoner, you've established serious training habits and built a strong athletic stride, and in that pace range, the research says you'll likely get a 3 or 4% improvement in running economy from the shoes. This is why no elite runner would toe the line in anything but a super shoe. But as a first-time marathoner, do you need that edge? Will it be impossible for you to accomplish your goals without these shoes? Performance-enhancing benefits? No, absolutely not. There are some good reasons why you might not want to invest in a super shoe. Research on the benefits for slower runners is mixed. One data analysis of slower marathoners showed time improvements even greater than among faster runners after adopting a super shoe. In contrast, a controlled study revealed that the slower the runner, the lower the boost in running economy, with the 940-mile runners seeing only about 1% improvement. Still, any help is appreciated in the marathon, and some experts believe that the real advantage may have more to do with the shoe's ability to reduce muscle breakdown and fatigue than with improvements in efficiency. If super shoes make finishing strong more likely, they might be well worth the $250-plus price tag. Be aware, however, that nearly a third of the slower runners in the same study showed a decrease in running economy. The shoes made running harder, not easier. Other studies have found even greater variability in runner response. This is partially due to the fine-tuned bounce and roll of a super shoe's midsole and plate. Every runner's stride is unique and interacts with the shoe differently. When we stage on a super shoe showdown for Outside Online with three runners and comparing 16 different super shoes head-to-head, we found that a shoe that felt magical to one runner often went clunk on another. Even if a shoe seems good when you are fresh and running strong, it might not be what you want on your foot when you start to tire. Super shoes exacerbate any stride imbalances because of a trampoline-like actions that magnifies all forces and movements for better or worse. Can you maintain the even posture and powerful push-off that a super shoe requires over 26.2 miles? A tall, wobbly platform isn't what anyone wants when doing the marathon shuffle. For slower first-time marathoners, the risk of a super shoe impeding their efforts may not be worth the meager potential reward, especially at these prices. If you decide to go with a super shoe, be sure to test out multiple models to find one that enhances your natural gait, rather than changing it or worse, fighting against it. Regardless of what you choose for race day, remember that the first rule of marathoning is to dance with the one who brought you. If in doubt, go with the old friends, your favorite tried and true trainers. Nothing different, nothing new. Any change opens you up to the possibility of blisters, an ultra stride that causes you to fatigue faster, even injury. If you want to wear a specialty shoe, start using it far enough in advance that you've adapted to it by race day. Gradually add miles over 8 to 12 weeks, building up to several solid marathon-paced runs and at least one long run. Marathon success depends far more on factors like how well you train, how well you hydrate and fuel, and how the weather gods treat you than on which shoes you wear. In the end, best shoes are the ones that get out of the way and quietly let your fitness shine. And the secret to camping comfortably in cold weather? Cotton canvas tents. Sure, it's heavy, but this setup allows me to bring the comforts of home deep into the mountains. It's by Wes Seiler. 2 weeks ago, a buddy and I went on an overnight hunting trip in the Montana wilderness. While we were searching for elk, we spotted the Aurora Borealis, that and a whole heap of early season snow. Luckily, we came prepared. We eschewed latest ultralight technical fabrics and relied upon a century-old technology. I'm talking about a cotton canvas tent. The best cold weather technical clothing prioritizes one performance metric above all others, breathability. Moving moisture away from your body keeps you comfortable and allows insulation to do its job. So why isn't it common for us to ask the same of our tents? That's the idea behind cotton canvas, a classic tent material that's making a comeback. If you ever spent a sleepless night shivering in a cold, damp plastic tent, you'll understand the problem. While silicone-coated nylon, ulthar, ultralight materials used by most major outdoor brands deliver extraordinary packability and value, their entirely waterproof nature tends to keep any moisture that gets inside, well, inside. And that's not just a problem when it's raining. Human bodies produce about 200 milliliters of moisture in an average night. Canvas tents work as a system with stoves. Your base layer and waterproof breathable hard shells don't evacuate moisture on their own. Your clothing relies on heat produced by your body to create a pressure differential with the outside environment to force moisture outwards. Canvas tents work the same way. It's important to think of them as part of a system. The material itself makes this pairing possible. Cotton canvas is naturally heat and flame resistant. Note that I didn't say proof. So with a reasonable amount of care, it's safe to house a wood-burning stove inside a canvas tent. Snow Trekker, a family-owned tent maker in Wisconsin, recommends keeping the stove at least 20 inches from the fabric tent body. Should you use a floor, camp on a sensitive surface, or set your floorless tent on a frozen lake to use an ice fishing shelter, something I'm planning to do this winter, then a heat-reflective, spark-proof mat can protect the ground from heat and embers. Tents designed to work with stoves will also feature chimney jacks made from flame and heat-proof materials like silicone. These allow the stove's chimney to pass through the tent without damaging the fabric. Get a fire going inside a stove and the chimney will pull smoke away from the tent while the stove's metal body radiates heat. Just like a radiator, you'll find in an older building. That heat is entirely dry. In cool to cold weather, the warm air created by the stove forces moisture through the canvas, creating an exceptionally dry environment inside the tent. If you're picturing a sauna-like experience here, you're not wrong. Snow Trekker actually makes a dedicated version of their tent designed to work as a portable sauna. But while camping, you don't need to keep the fire burning that hot. Cotton's unique properties help keep things dry. Worn on your body, untreated cotton has deservedly earned its cotton kills reputation. Cotton fibers are hollow inside and carry a slight negative charge. Water molecules carry a slight positive charge. That means cotton can absorb up to 27 times its own weight in water. Then it becomes really difficult to dry out. and next to your skin, silk cotton will keep you wet, potentially leading to hypothermia. Move that fabric away from your skin to the tent body, and cotton's propensity to soak up moisture can actually help keep you dry. Canvas weaves leave gaps between the individual fibers. This is great for breathability, but can let heavy rain through. But cotton swells when it soaks up all that moisture, so cotton canvas water resistance actually improves as it gets wetter. Canvas is strong, repairable, and durable. While nylon is stronger than cotton, that comparison is only for fabrics of equivalent weights. Most silicone-coated nylon tents measure between 40 and 70 denier. A single strand of silk is 1 denier. Most cotton canvas tent fabrics are measured in ounces per square yard rather than denier, but the stuff used for tents typically works out around 900 denier. That's to say these things are thick, burly, and yes, heavy. And while that weight means a canvas tent is never going to compare to a silk nylon alternative for backpacking, the upside is we're talking about a very strong fabric. Fabric strength is especially important for canvas tents because they're designed to be lived in rather than only slept in. It must be much larger as a result. Inside a canvas tent in bad weather, you're going to want room to stand up, dry clothing, cook, and hang out. Plus, you got to leave room for a stove and that 20-inch safety gap around it. Paired with a strong aluminum or steel pole structure, the heavy canvas fabric creates a resilient structure that can withstand weather in a way that flexible poles and thin fabrics of backpacking tents could never achieve. Cotton canvas has other benefits. First, you can patch it. Holes can happen, especially during transportation, but with cotton, you're never further away from repair than a few minutes with a needle and thread or glue and a patch. While exposure to sunlight, weather, and general wear and tear can shorten the lifetime of nylon tents to a few years, quality cotton canvas tents should last one or two decades when cared for properly. Longevity is good considering cotton canvas tents require a significant upfront investment. I own two canvas tents because each can perform a unique job. A portable option, Snow Trekker Mega Crew 13x13 is from $2,500. I'm 6'2" and 200 pounds. My buddy Connor is 6'8" and 260 pounds. I want a tent large enough for two big guys like us to comfortably stand up inside, sleep on cots, hang clothing to dry, cook, and hang out during late season hunts. And I wanted that tent, along with a stove, to pack down small enough that it could be carried into the backcountry on a single quad bike in a single trip. I also want a tent that could easily be towed on a plastic sled by a single person, on snowshoes or skis for winter camping trips in and around Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks, all the while accommodating two couples on ground pads. Those are widely divergent, somewhat conflicting requirements. Most canvas wall tents this large require transport by truck or pack mule, but Snow Trekker has two major technical advantages along with some unique design details that boost their tent's portability. Snow Trekker uses a proprietary cotton canvas that measures out at a very strong 7 ounces, but is much thinner than the fabrics used for most other canvas tents. That helps the tent body pack up small, something aided by a steeply sloped roof, short side walls, and a floorless design. It's an efficient design that uses the least amount of fabric possible to cover such a large internal area. Dwayne and Margaret Lotgids, the couple who founded the company, also work with Easton Aluminum to develop a unique pole frame that pairs a narrow wedge with wide guy lines to maximize space with minimal material. The tent measures 13 by 13 feet at its footprint and 9 feet 7 inches at its ridge pole, but weighs just 37.5 pounds without the stove and packs into a 13-gallon plastic tote. Connor and I set up this tent during truly awful conditions, unbelievably heavy wet snow combined with 50-mile-per-hour winds. The mega crew never felt anything but secure. And for something semi-permanent, White Ducks Outdoors 16.5 Avalon Bell Tent for $1,500. Last summer, Connor and his wife bought a 40-acre property a few hours north of our homes in Bozeman, Montana, with plans to build a yurt with help from their friends. But when his wife got pregnant, we went looking for a structure that'd be easy to put up but still was comfortable and reliable even in Montana's often extreme winter conditions. This bell tent was the answer. The unique thing about bell tents is their shape. Instead of a frame, there's only a single central pole, which is then staked out in all directions, kind of like a circus tent. The resulting cone shape is exceptionally stable in wind, no matter which direction it blows from. Since all load travels straight down through the vertical steel pole, the tent also resists heavy snow. The canvas is a thick, strong 11-ounce cotton. White Duck also features a zip-in PVC bathtub floor. With a 16.5-foot diameter and 9'8" peak height, there's room inside for a full-size XPED MegaMet dual sleeping pad, resting on a folding metal bed frame, plus the wood stove, camp chairs, and plenty of outdoor gear. While far from packable at about 120 pounds, it took two of us to carry the box it came in 10 feet from the truck to the deck. The level of strength and quality of the Avalon is reassuring. So far, it's withstood a 60-mile-per-hour windstorm without even a single guy line loosening. And for a versatile stove, they have the Knitco Alaskan Deluxe from $380. A originally bought one of these for the snow trekker, and I found it so indispensable that I bought a second for the white duck. I wanted to retain the ability to drag the snow trekker places, even while the other tent is set up on Connor's property. Made from 22-gauge steel that strikes a compromise between durability and weight, and measuring 22 inches long inside, the Alaskan Deluxe is large enough to fit pieces of commercial firewood without further chopping or cutting. It can hold 3 or 4 logs at once, which when paired with the right damp percentage can deliver all-night fires, and it weighs 18 pounds. But a canvas tent and metal wood stove is a lot of weight, space, and money. Is it worth it? When I don't take it camping, winter temperatures tend to make me rush through dinner in order to get inside my sleeping bag as soon as possible. With this setup, I'm lounging and taking my time to change clothes and cook. In the mornings, I'm putting on warm clothes that have dried out overnight, enjoying a relaxed cup of coffee, and then hitting the trail more rested and ready to go than I am through most of the summer. It's an experience that approaches the comforts of home way out in the mountains. And next up, we have, my friend is obsessed with being thin. How do I cope while traveling with her? I'm planning a river trip with a friend who follows an overly restrictive diet. As someone in recovery from eating disorder, how do I avoid slipping back into unhealthy habits? It's by Blair Braverman. When I was 13, like many young women, I developed an eating disorder and body dysmorphia. At 16, I started mountaineering, which was a profound catalyst for change. I learned that food was fuel and that my body could do so much more than simply look good. I got really excited about building strength and fitness. By my mid-20s, I would say I had recovered. I dealt with fluctuations in my weight and appearance without spiraling, lived a balanced, active lifestyle, and ate what I wanted without guilt or shame. I'm now 30 now and recently visited an old, very close friend from childhood who shared my adolescent despair and unhealthy eating patterns. I stayed at her house and noticed she hardly had any food. Just some tofu, greens, and fixings for light smoothies. No bread, no cheese or milk, no snacks. I listened to her talk about her eating habits, how she skipped dinner if she knew she was going to drink a lot that evening, or that she doesn't keep jam in the house because she'll eat it all. Isn't that the point? She told me that she knows she has to sacrifice certain foods to maintain a body shape that she's happy with, and that she's at peace with that. At the time, I thought, wow, she's still in it, this disordered relationship with food and her body. Thank God I grew out of it. Then I look at pictures of us on the beach from that weekend and notice my frame dwarfing hers. I came home from the trip triggered, questioning whether I needed to go on a diet, reevaluate my habits, or even get my hands on some Ozempic. Things I never think about. I want to be super clear. I love this woman and have my incredible time with her. She never commented on my body or what I ate, and she never would. But in her judgment of herself, I started to hear criticisms of my own habits and appearance, too. After a few weeks, the ship righted itself, and I felt once again at peace with myself and what I ate. We're now planning a river trip together, where we'll be sharing all of our snacks and meals. How can I avoid falling into the same old defeating thoughts when I'm with her? Should I talk to her? I don't even really know what I'd say, and definitely don't want to police her behavior. If I don't talk to her, what can I do to protect my own mental health and body image during our time together? Versions of this letter could have been written by so many women I know, including myself. This may be a tricky situation, but it's also a testament to your hard work towards body acceptance and how incredibly far you've come. Recently, I had an interaction with a close friend, a woman in her 30s that reminds me a bit of your situation. We were at the beach and she had recently ordered a new swimsuit. When she pulled it on, it was uncomfortably tight. I ordered the same size I wore in high school, she said, tugging the fabric down over her hips, which are objectively skinnier and much smaller than mine. I guess I should lose a few pounds. I didn't know what to say, so I just laughed. We went swimming, but I kept wondering what I should have said. I could have focused on praise, encouragement, you look great, but wouldn't that reinforce the idea that a slightly bigger body is bad? I could have said something neutral, bodies change. I could have taken a cue from my experience training dogs, discourage a behavior, replace it with an incompatible one, and ignore the statement completely before changing the subject. Look over there, a boat. Here's the kicker. My daughter was with us, and I want her to have a healthy relationship with her body. I hope she'll never experience the turmoil that so many women still carry. Luckily, she's a baby, so I doubt she's processed our conversation. She was too busy eating sand. But what if she'd been older, 3, 8, 16? What would I say then to my friend and her? And if I could figure out the right message to give my daughter, wouldn't that be the right message for myself too? For the sake of this calm, I took what felt like a risk and called my swimsuit-wearing friend to ask her for perspective on the interaction. She didn't remember it at all, but she remembered something else. I was in the kitchen with you and your husband, she said, and we'd just eaten sourdough bread that he had baked. I was thinking about how carbs make you gain weight. I said something like, what's this going to do to my gym goals? Without hesitating, he responded, what goals? Getting stronger? More endurance? It was so pure. It helped me catch myself. I always thought I don't have a lot of diet culture internalized, but there I was, trafficking in this culture of diet glorification. Even among my most feminist friends, admitted to troubled body image can feel like the last taboo. Women talk about body dysmorphia or disordered eating in the past tense, but stay tight-lipped on current struggles, even when they're outwardly obvious to folks who've been through it themselves. Part of this dynamic, I think, is generational. Millennials came of age during the extreme diet cultures of the 90s and 2000s, then matured and at least tried to deal with our shit as the body positivity movement rose in public consciousness. We were taught that our bodies were bad, and then that feeling bad about them is bad too. We're ashamed of the fact that we're still ashamed. So I understand your hesitation to talk to your friend directly, if you can comfortably talk about almost anything else. Commenting on body images can feel almost like a moral indictment, and anyway, what's you going to do? Get over them in time for your trip? You're better off risking honesty about yourself and confiding in your friends about your challenges, rather than confronting her about her own. You could frame the conversation in terms of asking for her support. Hey, can you help me with something? I've had some body image stuff come up lately, and I'm trying to really focus on accepting myself and having a healthy relationship with food. I think my goal on the river trip is just to be in the moment and not think about weight at all. If you notice me talking about weight or being self-critical, could you call me out on it? This is basically the truth, and it's a gentle way to tell your friend that diet comments can be triggering to you. It might also present an opportunity for her to bring up her own struggles, or at the very least to know that if she does want to talk about them someday, you're someone who would listen. In practical terms, make sure that when you pack for the trip, you're bringing a swimsuit and clothes that fit perfectly and make you feel confident. If you don't have any, buy some. Clothes that help you feel good about your body are generally important. I also think it's a good idea to reach out to another friend, someone who's not coming along, and ask her to be your support system. Let her know what's going on so she can check in with you after you get back. That way, if you end up feeling worse about yourself, she can help to remind you that this too shall pass. And if those bad feelings come back, they will pass, even if it takes a while to get through them. You already worked so hard to love your body and develop a healthy attitude towards food. That work is never wasted, even when you face setbacks. In fact, when you have negative thoughts about yourself and correct them, you're not failing. You're making your coping skills even stronger. Your body is strong as heck, and your mind is too. If you or a loved one is struggling with an eating disorder, call the National Alliance for Eating Disorders Helpline at 866-662-1235. For support, resources, and treatment options, visit www.allianceforeatingdisorders.com for more information. And Blair Braverman's writer writes Outside Tough Love column. She has previously written about how to develop more body confidence. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.